Live. Made in Sheffield. Made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Don? You know what? I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, Bluegrass, American Roots, and more. Lots more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
Before. It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best in new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X-T.
Good morning. Welcome to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org. You can listen online there and also download the podcast later and listen at your leisure. This show is all about science in all its different forms, and we play some rather cool music as well. You've got Julie and Paulie live in the studio as usual. We'll be speaking to our PG later in this hour. He'll be talking about microplastics, and our guest speaker for this week and indeed every third Saturday of the month, it's Gareth Morgan, who's a member of and also ex-president of the Sheffield Photographic Society, and he'll be talking about telling stories with photos. All good stuff. In the science news this week, though, we're going to cover basically the UK social media ban for children. So the UK government has announced that a ban on social media for under 16s will be implemented early next year in 2027 to make children happier and safer. Children will be blocked from accessing the largest social media platforms, including Snapchat, YouTube and TikTok. Or those deemed less risky, such as WhatsApp and Pinterest, will still be allowed. Children will also be blocked from communicating with adults online and live streaming themselves. And those under 18 will be barred from using artificial intelligence chatbots with romantic or sexual features.
Right, the UK government has insisted that the ban will be tougher than the Australian model, where children are still accessing apps by getting around age verification. Many platforms already require age checks under the Online Safety Act, especially if they offer pornography. Under the current rules, the verification has to be highly effective and can include, for example, using banking systems, mobile phone records and facial age estimation. The government will come up with similar rules for the social media ban by October this year.
And the biggest problem that Australia has faced since its ruling was implemented is that platforms have not been robust enough in their age checks. The UK government is understood to want Google and Apple, who run the majority of mobile phones operating systems, to have age checks upon purchasing the device. This would allow it to be applied across all apps more easily and evenly. In Australia, if these companies do not comply, they face a £26 million fine, but that figure has not been enough to deter the large tech companies. Under the UK government's penalty system, companies can be fined 10% of global turnover, a far larger threat to their businesses. Very interesting, because if you tuned in last week, we talked about Cosmeticorexia, where young children are becoming obsessed with makeup. So there's two big issues there, isn't there? And pretty much linked to social media. And of course, if you are listening on Catch Up, it is Saturday the 20th of June, which can mean only one thing. The summer solstice is looming, and that's tomorrow. So our Earth rotates on its axis once a day, producing the cycle of day and night. At the same time, the Earth moves around the Sun on its orbit over the course of a year.
However, the axis of rotation of the Earth is not lined up with the axis of motion around the Sun. Instead, it is tilted slightly at 23.44 degrees. This tilt means that during one half of the year, the north side of the Earth is tilted slightly towards the Sun and the south is tilted away. For the other half of the year, the reverse is true.
So the summer solstice occurs when one of the Earth's poles, which is north or south, has its maximum tilt towards the Sun. It happens twice yearly, once in each hemisphere, northern and southern, during that hemisphere's summer.
On the summer solstice, I'm going one ahead.
Oh, dear.
At the exact moment that the northern hemisphere is tilted towards the Sun, the northern hemisphere experiences its summer solstice. The southern hemisphere, by contrast, has its winter solstice.
Interesting. So on the summer solstice, Earth's maximum axial tilt towards the Sun is 23.44 degrees, as Paul said. And likewise, the Sun's declination from the celestial equator is 23.44 degrees as well. The summer solstice is therefore the day with the longest period of daylight and the shortest night of the year, when is at its highest position in the sky.
Get your curtains shut. At either pole, there is continuous daylight at the time of its summer solstice. The opposite occurs at the winter solstice, when there is continuous darkness at either pole.
So in the northern hemisphere, that's us. The summer solstice is tomorrow. It's the June solstice, and it's the 21st of June 2026. And the winter solstice for us is the December solstice, which is the 21st of December 2026.
So in the southern hemisphere, the winter solstice is in the June solstice, which is 21st of June 2026.
So that's tomorrow.
And the summer solstice is the December solstice, which is 21st of December 2026.
Yeah, interesting. So since prehistory, the summer solstice has been a significant time of year. Many cultures has been marked by festivals and rituals.
Yes, there was a programme all about Stonehenge.
There was.
And where it came from. But supposedly, they found an earlier Stonehenge, which is somewhat like 5,000 years older. Traditionally, in temperate regions, especially Europe, the summer solstice is seen as the middle of summer and referred to as midsummer, although today in some countries and calendars it is seen as the beginning of summer.
Indeed, and although the summer solstice is the longest day of the year for that hemisphere, the dates of earliest sunrise and latest sunset vary by a few days. This is because the Earth orbits the Sun in an elliptical form and its orbital speed varies slightly during the year.
The summer and winter solstices are key points in the year, along with the spring and autumnal equinoxes, which help to determine the seasons on Earth.
Indeed, and some might say the seasons are all a bit confused and get ever more so. But so in terms of the equinoxes, at two points in the year, the Sun illuminates the northern and southern hemispheres equally. These are known as the vernal or spring equinox and the autumnal equinox. On these days, there are approximately equal hours of daylight and darkness. In the northern hemisphere, the vernal or spring equinox occurred in March, 20th of March 2026, earlier this year, and marked the beginning of spring. The autumn equinox will occur in September, and that's 23rd of September this year, actually, 2026, and marks the beginning of autumn. In the southern hemisphere, it's vice versa. All very interesting. Oh, great track there from Joe Satriani, Summer Song. It came from his 1992 album, The Extremist. And we played that because we were talking about the summer solstice, which is for us tomorrow, Sunday the 21st of June 2026. All good stuff, eh? Of course, you're listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital, if you're in South Yorkshire, sheffieldlive.org. Talking about science in all its different forms every Saturday morning from 11 till 12. We should have our PG on the line. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning.
Good morning on this rather sunny morning.
Yeah, it's glorious, isn't it?
It is indeed. It's going to get ever hotter as well, yes, by the looks of it.
That's it. Keep hydrated. Keep cool.
Exactly. So what's caught your eye in the science news this week then, Paul?
Well, I thought I'd pick up on something that I mentioned last week, I think it was. And it's the University of Sheffield. And it's a great one for Sheffield folk because it's something for nought. They've created the Sheffield Music Trail, delivered by University of Sheffield, and it'll feature free live music across four city centre stages on June the 20th, which is today.
Woo! So it is!
And it starts at 12:30 and carries on through the afternoon. So,
and we've got the weather for it, most of the points.
Absolutely. So we've got a mixture of established artists and rising stars, they say. And alongside the event, they're partnering with Tickets for Good and Sheffield Independent Venues Alliance to buy tickets from local grassroots spaces and distribute them to NHS staff and community members facing financial barriers. So they're bringing an unforgettable afternoon of free live music. There'll be performances from 12:30 to 5, and they're going to be at the Diamond Stage, which is an outdoor stage up at Levy Grieve, near the Henderson's Relish Factory, University of Sheffield. They're going to be in Lear's Yard, which is outdoors again, and that's just off Cambridge Street. They're going to be at the Winter Gardens, in the Winter Garden Stage on Surrey Street. And if you want to see the new Harmony Works stage, it's in Canada House on Commercial Street.
Wow. So,
if you remember the all-day buffet that used to be there.
Yes.
Well, now it's an all-afternoon free music.
Some people might remember it's the gas board building, I think.
It was, yeah. Absolutely, yeah. So it's now got signage up for Harmony Works. So those are the four stages. Get yourself out and about, I say. Be careful with the sun. Keep yourself hydrated. If you drink alcoholic drinks, try and keep out of the sun because they don't mix particularly well. And enjoy a good afternoon for now.
I think it's the Pride Festival as well, is it, today?
I believe it is as
well. So it's all happening.
There's plenty going on around Sheffield, so I thought that was interesting. What else did I find interesting? Oh, yeah, I know. news that 75% of pet food, a study's found, have microplastics in.
Oh.
So, in more than three quarters of pet food products, a new study's found, research by the universities of Sussex and Exeter, found microplastics in 16 out of 19 brands that were tested, including, they say, very well-known ones. Cheaper value range products given to dogs, cats and wild animals contain more than the expensive ones it found. And it just reminded us that microplastics are tiny plastic particles, typically smaller than 5 millimetres. So several studies have suggested that these microplastics can harm animals and humans in many ways. So they say that further research is needed. And I was mentioning about water. I don't believe currently there's a UK standard for the amount of microplastics in drinking water. So it's coming from all angles, I think, is the problem. We've been using plastics now for a reasonable amount of time and in huge amounts, and they're starting to dissipate out in various ways to become microplastics within water, within food, and within the very air we breathe. So, sort of interesting. So I thought, well, okay, but what does that actually really mean for us human beings? So I checked with the BBC. We've got a great article under their future heading on BBC, and it's called "How Do the Microplastics in Our Bodies Affect Our Health?" And they say microplastics have been found even inside our bones, but what's the impact it's having on health? And so they run through a list. So they're saying that in a field in the sleepy corner of Hertfordshire, barely an hour's drive north of London, it houses the world's longest running agricultural experiments. They were initiated by Victorian aristocrat and landowner John Bennett Laws, and they later became a successful pioneer of modern fertilisers. And his aim was to test out the various ideas for boosting wheat production. But what he did was to collect samples and use that as the only means at the time of storing data. So these collected samples of the dried wheat grain, straw and soil from the field were bottled away. It started in 1843, and Laws didn't really have an idea what this tradition would endure for another 182 years, but it's created a remarkable archive of samples. It's now housed at the research facility at Rothamsted Research in Harpenden. And Andy MacDonald, the current custodian of the archive, said he's also affectionately known as the keeper of the bottles because of this library of record. And the samples were collected during the 40s and 50s, actually contained radioactive traces.
Oh, yeah.
Reflected the fallout from the nuclear weapons testing. And there's also another unwelcome record which can be found in the bottles, and that's the emergence of microplastics. So according to one famous estimate, we might consume up to 52,000 microplastics per year. And while that precise figure has been subsequently challenged, it's clear that they're entering the human body in significant quantities. And they can be ingested through our food, the liquids we drink, or absorbed from the air as we breathe. And they say that microplastics have quickly become ubiquitous. And they've been found in bodily fluids from saliva and blood and sputum and breast milk, along with an array of organs, including the liver, kidneys, spleen, brain, and even the inside of our bones. So they say there's a steady convergence of evidence that has all pointed to one question, and then what exactly is happening to our health? So in the samples that were housed at the Rothamsted research, MacDonald says there's a clear dividing line before and after the plastic era began. He says the use of plastics in society being coming into a large scale in about the 1920s, and we see a very big increase from the 1960s onward, and some would have inevitably have ended up in the soil through atmospheric deposition, and you can also imagine microplastics being shed from things like tractor tyres. So today it's thought that around the world humans are ingesting and inhaling more microplastics than at any time in recorded history, and that's from a study that was published in 2024. They found the consumption of the particles had increased sixfold since 1990, and particularly in various global hotspots, including the US, China, and parts of the Middle East, North Africa, and Scandinavia. but finding out how they were affecting health has been a bit more of a tricky thing. So one way to find out is what's known in medical circles as a human challenge trial. Now, that's usually carried out in the realm of infectious diseases, but involves participants agreeing to deliberately infect themselves with the pathogen in order to help scientists better understand the effects on the human body. So that's where the clinical trials, I think, to test new drugs and to identify things about different illnesses. So in the early 2025, 8 brave volunteers, they say, entered a lab in central London and willingly gulped down a solution of microplastics for which they got a small fee.
I hope it was worth it, Paul.
Yeah. So this particular study, which was funded by Minderoo Foundation, represented the first time that such a challenge trial had come out with plastic, though the results haven't yet been published.
Oh.
So one to wait for with bated breath, I believe. But those who've been diagnosed with dementia prior to their death had up to 10 times as much plastic in their brains compared to those without the condition. And that concept, according to Stephanie Wright, a researcher at the Imperial College London, who led the trial, is that many of us are unwittingly carrying out this experiment to our own bodies on a daily basis. As I said, things like your drinking water, there's no standard for the amount of microplastics that can be allowed in it. So the team copied some of the common ways through which many ingest microplastics. That's, for example, dipping plastic-sealed tea bags in hot water, microwaving fluids in a plastic container, and they asked volunteers to drink liquids and then attempted to follow up what happened next. So they know that heating and hot water are the worst-case scenarios for plastic ingestion, and that can really facilitate the release of microplastics from commonly used plastic items. So tea bags, you need to be having a look and seeing if they're actually a paper bag and not one that contains plastics, and a lot of them do contain plastics. So to assess this, Wright measured the volunteers' blood at repeated time points over the course of 10 hours, and they publish the data later. They'll publish it later this year, and it'll provide the first concrete information on typical concentrations of microplastics which end up circulating around our bodies in the wake of a cup of tea or a microwave ready meal.
I was just going to mention that, Paul, because microwave meals, invariably, they're in plastic, aren't they? You don't put them in another container. You just take the outer wrapper off, take the film off, or prick the film and put it in.
Yeah, and I think Chris has mentioned about, the supermarket's love of plastic to wrap things, to seal things, to transport things. So there's an awful lot of exposure to plastics, and this is an experiment which is trying to get to some answers from that. But they also say that it's fairly ubiquitous, and in that they're saying if you go into hospital, invariably, if you have oxygen, they'll use a plastic tube. If you're having infusions, injections, transfusions, there's usually plastic tubing involved. And quite often, if you're breathing your air through plastic tubing, you're inhaling it. So it's really something showing up in some studies where there's certain types of microplastics that can impede the growth of bone and muscle cell. That's from Chinese research released in late 2024. And another paper followed in early 24, where a group of Italian researchers identified microplastics in plaques found in the carotid arteries. So that's your major vessels which deliver blood to the brain. And of people with early stage cardiovascular disease, they linked their presence to worsening disease progression. And over the following 3 years, individuals carrying these microplastics in plaques had a 4.5-fold greater risk of stroke and heart attack or sudden death. So in February of 25, a group of scientists identified microplastics in the brains of human cadavers, and most notably those who'd been diagnosed with dementia prior to their death had up to 10 times as much plastic in their brains compared to those without the condition. And they said they were shocked. Matthew Campen of the University of New Mexico, who was a toxicology professor who led the study. So when it comes to the brain, his belief is that the tiny plastic particles circulating in the bloodstream could be hijacked by the brain's high metabolism, and they would hitch a ride into our central nervous system on the back of the fats known as lipids, which the brain requires for energy. So we also find that high lipid content in the brain, especially in the white matter, makes for an ideal environment for these plastics. So it's says the brain also has a notoriously slow clearance mechanism. And in dementia, the blood-brain barrier, which is designed to stop foreign objects accessing the brain, is impaired, so adding to further uptake of plastics. Both Campen and the Italian study found microplastics in carotid arteries that stop short of claiming a direct causative link between the microplastics and either dementia or heart disease. But obviously, the plastic particles, they say, were acting in synergy with other factors driving ill health and exerting an additional toll on the body's systems over the course of many years. Also, studies on bottled water, for example, have found that a single litre can contain as many as 240,000 different plastic particles of varying dimensions and materials. So among them, researchers identified no less than seven different categories of plastic, ranging from a form of nylon called polyamide to polystyrene. And there are numerous types of plastics, each with different compositions, which degrade in various forms and shapes. Verena Pichler, who is the Associate Professor of Pharmaceutical Chemistry at the University of Vienna in Austria, said the term microplastic doesn't capture the variability of what we're dealing with. So other challenge for researchers is that different people, various microplastics may be doing very different things. So she points out that researchers suggested certain plastic particles can absorb environmental toxins and carry heavy metals, while various chemicals added to plastic may interact with a network of hormones in the body. Nanoplastics, that's the plastic particles less than 1 micrometer in size, much smaller than microplastics, and nanoplastics, this is less than 1 micrometer in size, much smaller than microplastics, which are 5 millimeters or less in length, and may even be more damaging as they're small enough to enable them to cross into cellular membranes and gather within cells. So it's pretty frightening prospect, and I think that some microplastics have been found to act as a hub for so-called antimicrobial resistance genes, which again then can interact with bacteria, viruses, fungi or parasites to confer resistance against drugs.
Oh dear.
Yeah.
But there's also, you know, talk about plastic, Paul, there is the thing about the glass tax, isn't there, at the minute, where the government's, you know, because glass is heavy,
yeah.
I think it's cost more to transport.
Yep.
So the track, well, what are you going to package it in then? It's going to be plastic, isn't it? Because plastic's light, but you can't, you know, you can recycle it, but...
Well, that's why it's so prolific, as I say. You know, the supermarkets and people love to use plastic packaging, you know, to try and keep things in the appearance and style that we've come to expect over time. It used to be that you'd go and purchase things from tubs, drums, bags, sacks, you know, other forms of sort of containment. But plastic has become, you know, pretty much throughout life. And, it's not always apparent, or it's not always a key point that you think of when you're doing something. Say, going into hospital, if you put an oxygen, which you might need desperately, you could be inhaling microplastics.
Indeed, and you've picked a great song, Paul. Bit of X-ray specs.
Well, we did.
Well, we found it. Fortunately, we didn't have Plastic People by Frank Zappa, but we have got X-ray specs with Plastic Bag.
Sounds a good one.
Brilliant, Paul. We'll speak to you Monday, Glory Days, Rock Show 1 till 3.
Thank you, Paul.
Bye-bye.
Look forward to it.
Bye.
Yeah. Bye. Bye.
That's a rather interesting track, isn't it? Plastic Bag by X-ray Specs. I think we might have got that from our Chris, and we played that because RPG was talking about microplastics, more widespread than you might think. Of course, listen to Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org. Talk about science in all its different forms every Saturday morning, 11 till 12. We should have Gareth Morgan on the line. Good morning, Gareth.
Good morning.
Oh, loud and clear. Of all our guest speakers, you are the clearest sounding one. I don't know how you manage it.
I don't know. Nothing.
Brilliant.
To do with me.
The technology must be the same, but I don't know how you do it. But thanks for joining us, Gareth, yet again.
Pleasure.
And for people who don't know, you are a member of and also ex-president of the Sheffield Photographic Society.
Yes, that's right.
Doing very well as a club and as a photographer yourself. I keep seeing your pictures everywhere on social media.
Well, yeah, we've been quite busy. I mean, we're in the summer break at the moment. So, we meet up.
I noticed you were down at Victoria Keys.
Yes, we went down and we had a professional model with us, and did a few shots around the Keys, which kind of fits into what we're talking about.
Oh, yes.
Because some of that was like storytelling type pictures.
So today you're going to be talking about telling stories with photos.
Yeah. So, I mean, this came partly out of that walk. I was thinking about that. And also we're doing some work, as you know, I work at Calum Island Museum. And I'm doing some work at the moment with some historical photographs. And it got me thinking about how those photographs tell a story. And sometimes all you get is the photograph. You know, we get donated maybe an envelope full of photographs. We don't even know what company it is sometimes. And you have to go in and interpret the various elements to try and figure out what it is you've got.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is quite interesting. Ken Hawley himself, who obviously was the guy who started the collection, was an absolute master at interpreting photographs. And in fact, if you ever go to the museum, we have on one wall, we have a huge photograph blown up, which Ken has made various comments, and there's about 12 different comments, that tells you about every little thing, you know, what's on the workbench, what's
really?
In the background,
wow.
Stuff like that. And from that, you can tell that it's I've forgotten now whether it's a grinding shop or a packing, but it kind of pins down all the elements that are used to tell you the story of that picture.
Wow.
So I thought that might be a kind of interesting subject to talk about today. There's kind of two ways to approach it. One, you can look at it as one individual photograph that tells a story, or you can put together a set of images into, well, what we would call a photo essay or a storyboard or something like that, or a series of photographs that together tell the story. And if you think about some of the great photographs in history, they really tell a story. You know, you think about Robert Capa's picture of a soldier in the Spanish Civil War. I'm familiar with it. You know, the guy's apparently just been shot, and this photograph just captures that instant. Or there's the picture of a young girl in Vietnam running away from a Nazi.
Yes, I do know that one.
The student in Tiananmen Square stood in front of a tank.
Yeah.
Which is, you know,
they're iconic images, aren't they?
They are. They tell a story. And in fact, all of those, there are, you know, like Tiananmen Square, there's video of that as well. But I still think the single image of that kid stood in front of a tank is much more powerful than any video story.
Yeah.
So that's why, to me, I mean, but then again, I would say that I'm slightly prejudiced because I'm a stills photographer, and that's what I enjoy. So it's about looking for opportunities to really have a narrative element to the story. And that's something that gets the viewer thinking about the image, maybe asking questions about it, or building up a story in their own mind about what's going on. And typically for a single image, you know, the human element is a huge part of it. So you're looking to include a person, but in the act of doing something or something happening, it's what Cartier-Bresson used to call the decisive moment, which is a key concept in photography. You're capturing the moment where something is happening to that human element, or they're doing something that makes you think about it.
Yeah.
And you put it in the context of, you know, juxtaposition with something else that's going on. It's an opportunity to also use kind of perhaps light and shadow a bit more. Yeah, a bit more intentional, moody lighting, that sort of thing. And then you come up with an image that quite often kind of tells a bit of a story. So I was thinking about this last week when we did the walk around Victoria Keys. We took some of the pictures you've probably seen on the quayside themselves and against some of the historical backgrounds. But we also went into one of the bars, Joanna's bars, and there's a series of pictures there that in a part they tell a story. There was Kimmy, our model, going into the bar. But the one picture that I took, and it was kind of lucky, but I took a picture of her sat looking out of the window, and I was outside. So you've got a reflection of all the keys in the background.
Oh, yeah.
And she sat there looking all on her own, looking kind of sad and lonely, which wasn't what I'd asked her to do, but you know, just caught that moment. And, I mean, she loves it. She says it's, you know, it's a really, because it's kind of different.
It's caught that moment of reflection almost.
Yeah, and it, you know, a lot of people at the club have seen it and said, oh, it really makes you think about, you know, has she been stood up? Is she waiting for a date?
Yes, you don't know, do you?
You know, and all those sort of things go through your mind. And that makes it a bit of a story picture, which is kind of what I was hoping for, but it wasn't quite the story I'd thought about. But anyway, I'm taking credit for it now that I've got it.
But it's that expression. I think it's a young Indian girl, maybe. There's a classic photo. It's just this girl and her eyes.
Yeah, it's the Afghan girl.
It is, and that's an iconic image, and it's the look on her face. There's a lot of emotion there, but what is that emotion? Is it sadness? Is it grief? Yeah. Is it loss? What is it?
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. And that, I mean, the really interesting thing about that is that Steve Curry went back recently and photographed that girl as a mature lady.
Did he?
And, I mean, she's obviously had a hard life, you could tell that. But the eyes are the same.
The eyes are the same.
You know, those eyes don't change, and that's what stood out in the first photo. Mm. And that is a classic example of how one image could tell a story. You know, you think about Yusuf Karsh took a photograph of Churchill with a cigar. He just lit a cigar, put it in his mouth, and there was this certain defiant look. And it told you everything you needed to know about Churchill at that moment in time.
Yeah.
Just a great story. So that's one way of doing it. The other way is to put together a series of pictures. And these tend to be either a storyboard, so you could collage them together, or you could just have them as five or six individual photographs that tell the story of what it is you're looking at. And you need to, I mean, it sounds simple, but you do need to think about how those photographs fit together. And there are probably four or five themes you need to look at. The first thing is, it's called the establishing shot. And that would be typically a fairly wide angle shot of the environment and the subjects you're going to work with, but not a lot of detail. So, you know, you're just trying to set the scene, really. Next stage is what's called the medium shot, and that's where you kind of introduce the main characters. So you might take a portrait of one or two of the subjects, but from a bit of a distance, so it's a full-length portrait. Then you get into what's called the kind of hero shot, and that's a close-up of what it is you're actually getting at, what you're talking about. And that's the picture that everything else hooks around. And then you finish off with typically even more detailed close-up just to tell the story. So it's about thinking about all of these, how they all hang together at the end and tell the story. And it's perhaps better to explain it with an example. So I think I've mentioned in the past that my daughter has, and this is going to sound a bit weird, but she has a half share in two horses. Sounds a bit odd. But
Can't put them together, no.
Yeah, no, it don't work like that. Well, she has a half share of 2.5, because there's also Colin, who's a Shetland pony, who's...
Oh,
he rules the roost.
But
there are two horses that she owns with a friend, there are also two goats, and she's got two dogs, so it's a real menagerie when we go there. Anyway, a couple of weeks ago, I was there helping out, and the farrier turned up. And, I had a camera in my boot. I've always got a camera somewhere around. So I grabbed my camera, and the first thing I did was take a picture of the two horses just coming out of the stables. Then I took a picture of Mick, who's the farrier, walking down the yard. And then he was working on one of the horses, Athena. It had a problem with the shoe wasn't fitting properly or something. So I took a picture of the farrier working on that shoe. And actually what it was a bit of metal had got in underneath. We don't know where from. And made like saw things. So I got in and got a real close-up of him taking that out. And it's a kind of close-up of Mick's hands, which, I mean, he's been a farrier for 20-odd years. They're like leather. They're just amazing.
Yeah. So that's your hero shot.
That was the hero shot. I mean, I would have liked it if he was fitting new shoes, because then you get, you know, they're all hot and steam. You get all the steam and all. I didn't get that this time, but I'll get when I know he's coming back. I'm going to go back and do that. And then he laid out, he brings a lot of his tools in a leather tool roll, which he laid out on the floor. So I took a detailed shot of that. I took a shot of Athena's hoof where the thing had come out, and Mick had kind of carved away some of the old nail to the hoof to make it clean again and put dressing on it. So I ended up, I think, with five or six shots that I then put together into a little series and given to my daughter, which she's very happy with. But that's the way you can, you know, by thinking about it, you can take different aspects of the same scene and put them together to make a story.
So coming soon to an exhibition, I imagine.
I might use those. We have a themed competition at the club. I might use them. I've done them in black and white, so they're quite moody. And the interesting thing is, because I was rushing a bit, one of the things, it's not technically perfect, but it's got the right mood.
Ah.
And I would say with a story photograph more than anything else, the mood is more important than whether it's technically perfect, which is a bit, those of you who know me know that, you know, I like my photos to be sharp and accurate and all of that good stuff. This one is a little bit, the focus is slightly not in the place I wanted it to, and I would have framed it better with more time. But the light on it is perfect, and it shows all the sort of gnarly skin on the back of the Nick's hand and the hairs on the horse's leg coming down. Just the light caught it perfectly. So that's staying in, even though it's perhaps not.
Oh, so you're not tempted to post-process then?
I've done a little bit, but it's not one of those you could improve. The things that are slightly wrong with it are intrinsic to the image.
Yes.
And you probably couldn't deal with them anyway.
And you're capturing that, as you said, you're capturing that, just that moment. You went there. You weren't expecting to do that anyway, were you, to be fair?
It's a bit more real, I think, you know. And that's, I mean, I did do the things I would tell everyone to do when you're telling a story. You know, vary your angle, vary your direction. Too many people take photographs from standing height. You know, try kneeling down, try tilting the camera, try lying down if you have to, but change your angles, change your position, move around. And then, you know, I would say I took in probably the 10 minutes that Nick was there. I bet I took 50 photographs.
Wow.
Well, 45 of them ended up in the bin because it's not worth keeping. But the five that I wanted to tell the story, I mean, I would say three of them stand on their own anyway, but put together, they're much more powerful as a storyboard than, you know, any individual one. The rest were just, you know, variations on a theme. So just, and I got to the point now where I'd have to buy like several more computers if I keep every shot I take. So I throw a lot of stuff away.
It's discipline. I still think one of my pet hates is still people who just put loads and loads of pictures on social media. It'd be like hundreds, 150. You're just not. You need yourself to choose what you think is the best, and then it's better. I think less is more sometimes.
Well, it is, and you'll find that for, you know, you look at the club stuff, and I post a lot of stuff on there. I never post more than three or four images.
Yeah.
It's, you know, because they're much for muchness. And also, you want to put your best stuff out there.
Yes.
Not the dross.
How do you choose? But does your view change on what you think is good? You know, you might look back and you take something, you think, oh, I don't like that. And then you might come across it years later and think, actually.
Well, it can do. And sometimes it's situational. So, you know, you may have a, we have competitions with themes, and a photograph that on its own didn't appeal to you very much may fit a particular theme. But then, you know, you have to, I've got a ridiculous amount of photographs on. I have two hard drives permanently backing up stuff and two other hard drives backing up the backups. And they're all getting pretty full. So, I mean, I've got hundreds of thousands of images. It's ridiculous, really. And they are catalogued, so I can usually find stuff. But I find stuff I want, stuff that I thought wasn't very good at the time. I'm probably never going to go back and think, oh, that was good. I don't throw it all away straight away. I mean, I on any shoot, I will throw 50% away almost immediately because I always take, you know, we've talked before about this process of bracketing. I might take the same shot and then open the aperture up a little bit, close it down a little bit. So I've got three almost identical shots. Well, you only want to keep the best of those because the others are not worth keeping.
Yeah, it's an interesting
one. And it's the same in a story. Take three or four versions of what you're trying to tell, but only include the best one in the final edit, if you like.
Yeah, I don't know if you've been reading about it. It's Marilyn Monroe's. It's nearly 100 years since she was born. And somebody's released some photographs. They must have photographed her very early on in her career before she was really Norma Jean still. And what they were saying, how that person captured her, it was a look and a feeling that you got a lot of emotion out of her, that she'd had a hard life behind that. And, you know, if you look at pictures of Marilyn Monroe, for example, some of them, or most of them, they're not iconic, like the one everybody knows of from a particular angle, the way, and it's just, I thought that was interesting, how you capture somebody's feel.
It's very true. You capture, I mean, a lot of famous people, some of the best pictures are when they're off guard.
Yes.
That tells you much more about them than when they're all made up and, you know, primped and pruned and all that. But I think that exhibition is coming up at the National Portrait Gallery.
I think it is. And I thought, because there's some pictures I've seen of Marilyn, and she almost, you wouldn't recognise it was Marilyn Monroe, particularly when she was younger.
Yes.
So somebody honed
in. She had some work done. It wasn't cosmetic surgery in the way we know it now, but I think she did have some work done. And of course, once you get, I mean, I know this with, I go on photo shoots and, you know, somebody walks in and you think, oh, that's a nice, you know, looking person. They go in and come out of makeup and it's like a different person.
Yes.
It's like, you know, think, my God.
It's different, isn't it?
I keep thinking maybe I ought to go in that way.
No. Interesting. We don't often watch this, but we watched Beckham. There was a documentary on Beckham in 10 photos.
I've seen...
Yeah, they do other people. But it's a similar thing. You're telling somebody's life through 10 iconic photos, and it can be the most unassuming of photos in some respects.
Yeah.
But I think that's a really interesting thing to do. And I'm not that particularly keen on Beckham, but I just thought I'd love to see his journey. And an innocent young boy who happened to be good at football, and, rest is history, isn't it?
that's another story. With photographs, that's exactly the story of one guy's life, you know. It's
and now you change through that. Just before I let you go out, Gareth, what about the Ken Orley collection then at Kelham? You know, the story, are you doing more archiving then?
We're doing, but we've just received lottery funding for our next project. You know, we did a thing about cutlery.
Is this a knife? Your name on a knife blade? Yes.
We're going to do this a similar sort of thing, but based on Sheffield hand tools.
Oh,
it's. I think we're going to call it something like the Pride and Passion of Sheffield Skill or something like that. So we work, and the interesting thing is we're working with six companies that are still going.
Wow.
And we're going to do that, and then we're doing. We're going to invite people in and interview them who used to work for, you know, Stanley Tools, Niels, Footprint Tools, people like that. And you know, that's about telling stories and trying to keep it alive. And what I've been doing is kind of looking through the archive to find various photographs that will fit into that. I'm going to work on one of the streams, which is about Stanley Tools.
Obviously, I wonder why, Gareth.
So I've been looking at some old Stanley pictures, and it's amazing how you've got all the formal stuff of the products, but then in the stuff they gave us, there's pictures from behind the scenes.
Yeah.
And they really tell a story that is, it all fits together, really. It's like we planned it.
Wow, I know. So how on earth do you find time to do all this, Gareth?
I'm only spending a day a week on this at the museum, or maybe 2 days, depending. And you just, you know, it's concentrated work, because the beauty is we've got all the stuff. I don't have to deal with visitors anymore. I never was a very good guide, but
you just want to do with it. It's a legacy. It's a legacy issue, isn't it?
I think it's quite important, and it's, you know, people kind of think of Sheffield as a steel city, but actually the light trades were as important.
Yes.
You think about all the tool manufacturers, silversmiths, cutlers, you know, Sheffield's built on that as much as the big steelworks, really.
Yeah, that archive. I'm going to have to let you go, Gareth, but I was just going to ask you about, is it Ray Brightman, his collection of black and white photos?
Yes.
Is that going to be archived? And
it's on Picture Sheffield now.
Is it? Because that tells what a story of Sheffield.
Yeah, no, that is a... I should have mentioned that at the start. That is the classic storytelling set of pictures.
Because he was photographing things you didn't even realise you wanted to photograph, but because he did...
Well, because he did stuff for local papers, and you photograph things because they're there sometimes. They're not that interesting at the time. 20, 30, 40, 50 years later.
They're very interesting. They are. Yeah, for lots of reasons, but fantastic. Yeah. Fantastic chat as always, Gareth. Thank you very much.
Excellent.
Yeah, and we'll speak to you in about a month. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.